oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is dean at the Graduate School of Education.
Dr. Hard Talk Pope.
Hard Talk. Yeah, I like that.
We're talking about difficult conversations today.
Okay.
So I wanted to start with one for you.
We're going to start right off with a difficult conversation. Yeah.
So,
okay.
So I'm not sure it's difficult so much as awkward.
Oh, great. So
I don't know the line between awkward and difficult. But so let's say you don't like your child's girl or boyfriend.
Oh.
Do you have the awkward conversation about this?
This is awkward. Can you give me the age?
Oh,
like a teenager?
Yeah, let's say deep in the teen years.
Deep in the teen years.
But
okay.
not 18.
So this is a thing.
Or it could be your 30-year-old.
Or it could be your 30-year-old. Are you speaking from experience? No, don't say that. Okay, here's the thing that I would say. I think that I would want them to choose their own person to date and have that ability to choose freely. I would hope that we would meet the person. I would hope that we could talk to the person. And then if we kind of decide, not our favorite, I think I probably wouldn't say anything if I didn't think that this person was sort of a dangerous, you know, serial killer or something. I mean, it's really up to my kids to learn and choose. No?
That's so punting on the question. So you wouldn't intervene. But it probably just oozes out of you that you don't like this person.
So would we be fake nice, right?
Yes.
I mean, probably we'd be fake nice. I mean, what you would like to think that whatever they see in the person, eventually we too will see in the person. Or sometimes, I mean, I know Wendy Mogul said this, like you kind of hope that your kid does make a slightly bad decision and then realizes it, but goes through that process of, I made a bad decision, and now I don't want to have it happen again.
They realize it after their third divorce.
I hope not. I hope not, Dan. But that's a tough, I would say that's a really tough conversation. And if I was worried about their health or safety with this person for any reason, and maybe I've just been watching too much TV, but there was just a storyline on This Is Us about this, that I would definitely say something. And I would say it in a sort of a nice way, but I would say, you know, that we do have some concerns, and can you help us, have you thought about this, or can you help us see this, that we're worried about sort of health or safety?
Wow.
You know, like if the person drives drunk.
Yeah.
Right.
You put your foot down on that.
Health and safety, I think parents need to put their foot down. Do you agree?
You skirted again the hard question, which is you don't like the boyfriend or girlfriend. But I don't disagree.
Has this happened to you?
So I'm a guy. I generally don't have conversations.
At all, just in general. Just avoid any kind of...
I just turn off the TV a little louder.
Conflict avoiding completely.
Okay. So today we're talking with Dr. Sujata Patel. And she is a psychiatrist at Stanford's Vaden Health Center, which is responsible for providing services to the students. Her professional interests range from working with students transitioning into and out of college and graduate school, mental health issues of the South Asian community, psychotherapy, and medication management for depression and anxiety. So psychiatrists can prescribe drugs. Psychologists cannot.
Yes.
Okay. Just
this is a good thing.
So welcome. Thank you for coming.
We're so glad to have you.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. Right out of the gate.
You got to do better than how I just did, so don't worry.
No, I'm putting you on the spot so I can put Denise back on the spot.
Oh, good. Oh, great.
So what are the three most difficult conversations?
That parents have?
That you have seen or experienced where you think this is really a tough conversation to have.
Wow.
Well, I think more in terms of themes rather than topics. And I think the themes would be we have different values. We have really strong feelings, and I guess the third one would be we're afraid.
I like
so
that.
Those would be my three themes.
Wow. So what's an example of a topic that sits under values?
I would say, for example, I'm thinking of the boyfriend-girlfriend question.
Yes, please help me. How should I have handled that?
I actually thought your answer was great.
Oh, thank you.
Because I do think that when it comes to those kinds of situations, parental meddling tends to backfire. We tend to drive the person closer to that person that we don't like very much. We need to give them a lot of space to explore relationships. I do think that if there's a safety issue, if you think there might be some abuse or some, there are some red flags, yes, you want to speak up as a parent. But short of that, I actually think, actually, Wendy Mogul talks about this in one of her books that I was reading recently about, and she says, bring your enemies closer. So invite the person over. Get to know them a little bit. Be open-minded and try to get your son or daughter over time to see what you see, but not by actually interfering at all. Letting them have the time and space to explore things and trust them to have transmitted or accepted from you the values you transmitted to them so that they kind of understand what you look for in a healthy relationship. And let them sort out whether this relationship actually is following down that path or not. Most of the time, they'll figure it out.
It's so hard, right? Because as a parent, you don't want them to end up divorced, right? To Dan's point, you don't want to see your child in pain. And you think you know better. And you have a prefrontal cortex that is fully formed and theirs isn't. So you feel this need to step in. But you also, at some point, have to let them make their own decisions. And when and how is so tricky.
It is very tricky.
So what's an example around fear?
I would say around fear, I'm thinking about the coronavirus right now.
Yeah.
Right? It's everywhere. Kids are asking questions about it. Parents don't know what to say. And I think for me, it's really about first stepping back and thinking about our own emotions. What are we feeling about the situation? Getting a handle on that. And then thinking about how we can talk about it with our child in a way that's developmentally appropriate for them. So depending on their age, how much information to share, whether we let them ask the questions and then answer them, or whether we need to actually initiate the conversation. Often, I'll let them ask the questions, and they'll ask when they're ready to hear about it, generally. And if they ask a question about a topic, they're usually ready to hear the answer.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Dr. Sujata Patel about having some really hard conversations. And something that you just said reminded me of this very funny story, which maybe people have heard before. But the kid comes up to the parents and he says, you know, Mom, Dad, what's sex? And they are like, oh, gosh.
Turn up the TV.
Yeah, like, woo, this is a tough one. Okay, let's sit down. Let's have the whole conversation. And they, you know, go into this elaborate detail. And the kid's like, well, because it just says here, on my form for soccer, it says name and sex. And the parents are like, oh. So right when you said that, I thought, yeah, he wasn't really asking about sex. They jumped to that conclusion, but I love it. The kid's just trying to fill out a form.
Exactly. That's a very good example.
So we hit fear and we hit
values.
Values. And what the third one, that the third theme was.
Is this a test?
Yeah, Dan, what was it?
What was the third one?
I think it was we disagree.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
Do you have a good example of that?
I would say anything involving a teenager probably falls under that category.
I want to go to the party and you're not letting me go to the party.
Yes. And the way I think about those conversations is, again, we have to stop and reflect before we have them with our teenager. So think about what we're feeling and what we want to communicate to them. Also think about their perspective. Like, for example, the one about going to the party, we're thinking about safety.
Yes.
We're thinking about healthy boundaries and letting them have a gradual increase in their amount of freedom. They're thinking about us trusting them versus not trusting them. They're worrying about fear of missing out. And so if you look at it from their perspective, it's easier to kind of get to a middle ground. Although with teenagers, that can be tricky. Sometimes we're never going to get to a middle ground and we're going to have to disagree.
My son was thinking, is he going to catch me in a lie?
Yes.
That was his main thought.
Am
I going to recognize that he's lying?
Well, I think with the party, a middle ground is hard because they either go or they don't go. Like, what's a middle ground with a party where you know there's going to be alcohol?
Video conferencing?
You can't go to the party, but you can get your friends to video the party for you. What would you suggest?
I would say it could be anything from you can go to a party if I know who's going to be there, whether they're going to be parents around or not. Mm-hmm. If you do go, there's going to be a curfew. And no one's going to be driving if they've had anything to drink.
Right.
Those kinds of rules. And if they tell you they don't know who's having the party, the parents aren't going to be there, there's going to be alcohol, and they're not sure how they're going to get home, then that might be
right.
a no.
Right. Often they're like, well, we don't know. And when this happened to me, I'd say, okay, then I'm going to do my job as a parent. You might think this is too extreme. Dan, you might really think this is too extreme. But I would say, I'm going to do my job as a parent, and I'm going to call and see if there'll be adults there. And that was sort of horrifyingly embarrassing.
Yes.
And I said, well, it's my job as a parent to keep you safe. And if I find out that the adults are going to be there, I'll let you go. I thought that was kind of a fair thing.
Yes. I would say that if your child is embarrassed by you when they're between the ages of 13 and 17, you're doing a good job.
Oh, yay.
That's horrifying.
Okay. But Dan, I had to know, there have been kids who had died from alcohol poisoning at parties where there were no adults.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be sure.
This was for a daughter or a son?
I did it for both.
Wow.
I did it for daughters and sons. Huh. Yeah. I mean, this was, you know, sort of middle school, early high school. By the mm-hmm. time they can drive, you don't have a whole lot of control over where they're going. I mean, you can hope, as you can say, make good decisions. That's like always my line when they're leaving the house, make good decisions. But no, in middle school parties, for sure, you want to make sure there's adults there. And I did it for early high school, mm-hmm. ninth grade too. Hmm. I'm looking at you like... reaffirming.
No, you're good. You're good. You're good. I think that was a very adult thing to do.
Thank you, Dan.
Yes. It's our job to set these boundaries and their job to push against them. So they're both doing their jobs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So let me try truly difficult conversations. your sibling has passed away. How do you start that conversation?
With
I have a 12-year-old child, and I have a 14-year-old child, and the 14-year-old's passed away. The 12-year-old doesn't know this. It was a sudden death, let's say. How do I start into a difficult conversation like that one? Is there any answer, you know?
That one's really tough.
Yeah.
And I think that's one where you have to just acknowledge that nothing's going to make that easier other than maybe not telling them, which isn't really an option, right? And so we have to tell them. I think that you have to just sit them down and say, I have terrible news. And you tell them what happened. And the key there is, I think you have to be able to let them express their feelings and not try to reassure them, because nothing is going to reassure them in that moment in a helpful way. I think that's the hardest part, is letting them feel what they're going to feel and letting them see you feeling what you're feeling at that moment.
So do I help them process? So here's a less horrifying situation. one of the unfortunate parts of my job is I tell people that we've interviewed a number of candidates for a faculty position, mm-hmm. and I call the ones who didn't make it.
Yes.
And that's a very hard conversation. I start out by telling them right away, you know, and mm-hmm. then I always debate, should I then give them something to hang on to process it. You know, it's not about you, it's about me, you know, like you might do in a relationship.
Or, like make them feel, you want to make them feel better.
Yeah,
you know you've just made them feel
not great.
You want to do something to make them feel better.
Is that a mistake? Is it better to say, thank you so much, you know, I'm sure, and stop? Or do I try and help them feel better, in which case maybe I'm kind of overstepping or it's not a clean enough, I didn't pull off the Band-Aid fast
enough. It's awkward. That's awkward.
It is hard. I think talking to students who interview for positions.
Same thing.
In my
Same
job,
thing.
You know, I think that it can be helpful to share something that's authentic and true, but also positive in those moments. So if it's something you can share that actually rings true to them and feels authentic, yes, that's helpful.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Dr. Sujata Patel about having really hard conversations. And that's a hard one, Dan. I think for educators, giving kids bad grades, calling a parent and saying, you know, we've had an issue in the classroom. Actually, you have a story about that, right?
Did I ever tell you about this?
No, tell.
I'm a new teacher in a tough part of Los Angeles, a tough school. It's a middle school, and I'm new, and I'm getting beaten up mm-hmm. by behavioral problems.
They're throwing spit wads.
I'm not very good at it yet. So anyway, someone says, well, you need to call their parents. So this one kid who was really a pest, and I'm not saying his name, so I can say he's a pastor.
You can say that.
I called, and the father answered the phone, and I said, "Hello, Mr. X. I'm Dan Schwartz. I'm your son's teacher." And he said on the phone, the first thing that came out of his mouth was, "Boy, get my belt."
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so
that's horrible.
Yeah, so I blew the difficult conversation, and the dad was going to blow it as well.
But you did, all you said was, "Hi, I'm your son's teacher." You didn't even do anything really wrong.
Maybe this kid had a history of this.
Yeah. So what would you do in the case of sort of advice for educators in that situation where you have to make a bad call?
You have to call a parent.
Mm-hmm. About a problem.
Yeah. About a problem.
Yeah. I would say start out by, again, thinking before you call them about what you want to say. If you can throw in anything positive about their kid at the same time, that's really helpful. Anything that gets them to understand that you actually have gotten to know their kid a little bit.
Oh, that's a good insight.
Yeah, that is good. Yeah,
when I call parents about a student who's struggling, for example, that's always tricky. I always get permission before I call, of course, but I always try to start out by talking about their kid in a way that lets them know that I spent time with their kid. Before I start jumping in with my insights, mm-hmm. I want them to know that I spent at least an hour or two meeting their kid and getting to know them. Otherwise, they envision me as a person who saw their kid, gave them a prescription, and then said goodbye.
Right.
And that I didn't actually spend any time getting to know who their kid is. But once they know that I understand their kid, they'll listen to what I have to say.
That's interesting. It's slightly different. I've heard in the other aspects of the medical profession, if you come in to deliver bad news to a patient, that's the first thing that happens. But
you,
I guess that's...
You should just say the bad news, boom.
Right out of the gate.
Rip the Band-Aid off.
Because they're waiting to hear.
Yeah, I think it's a little different when you're talking to a parent
about a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And this isn't necessarily what I consider terrible news. It's more, you know, the bad news is your kid is struggling. The good news is we're helping them.
Right.
And they came in to get help.
Right.
And so,
very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Dr. Sujata Patel next on SiriusXM, talking about having and handling difficult conversations.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this.
Okay.
I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope
from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Sujata Patel about having difficult conversations, parents to teachers, teachers to parents, parents to kids in particular.
Yeah. So I think I'm probably very bad at difficult conversations when I'm the one who's bringing it up, partly because I'm spending so much time worrying about my own feelings.
Your feelings?
Yeah, I feel bad. I feel guilty. I feel that I'm not helping them enough. And that's sort of probably interfering with clarity in them. I mean, I feel bad for good reasons, but still, I should do that afterwards or something. But so are there what is a very common mistake that people would make in difficult conversations, and what should they do instead?
I think that often we focus more on the content than the process. The feelings are the most important part of the conversation, actually. Getting to a resolution is not as important, but if each person leaves the discussion feeling heard and understood and validated, then that is a successful conversation. I think that's particularly true with parents and teenagers or parents and children.
Really? I would have said a successful conversation is if I fix the problem.
No, you would have got what you wanted out of it, but that's not looking at it from the kid's point of view.
Didn't we just point out I'm a little self-centered about this?
But I think even if we fix a conversation with a kid, they leave feeling like the parents solved the problem, mm-hmm. not that they actually solved it themselves. So I think if we're able to listen and let them solve the situation on their own, they will leave feeling empowered and also heard and understood.
Money? Does it work for money?
What does that mean? Like, I want more allowance? I feel like I deserve more allowance.
I gave my bookie $40 and he's coming after me. I need money.
You and your 12-year-old says that to you? Yeah, that's a problem maybe that we should. That would be good.
But same strategy. It's a conversation about money. The primary goal is to hear them out and understand their point of view. And then how about the second conversation? Am I allowed to fix it then?
Well, no, if you can hear their point of view, but I worry that the kid is going to still not feel heard if they don't get the resolution that they want. That's because I think of them as young and not, you know, well, wait, yeah, that's great that you've heard me, but I'm still not getting my allowance raised. So how do you resolve that?
Well, I think that if we first get clarity on our own feelings about money, it's easier to go with to our kids and talk with them about money.
Mm.
And we can communicate our money values to them, hear their point of view, reflect back what they said to us. And they may stomp off and be angry, but that still may have been a good conversation.
That's really important. So they can stomp off, be angry,
yes.
slam the doors.
Exactly.
But that doesn't mean that you have just failed miserably.
Exactly. I think that's actually a key misconception about teenage and parent conversations, which is if they're going to somehow actually thank you for your insights. And
that was such a lovely conversation,
yes,
Mom.
And be grateful for your wisdom. That will never happen, right? They're going to stomp off and slam the door and be angry, but they still may have felt that even though you disagreed, you actually listened to them and heard them.
Hmm. That's good. That's hard, but that's good.
Same thing about sex?
Yes. I think sex is difficult because lots of parents aren't comfortable talking about sex. Actually, probably the kids are more comfortable than the parents are most of the time.
The kids are more
comfortable than the parents, I think.
Interesting.
Well, your example of
it's the soccer form. Well, yeah. That kid wasn't asking about sex. I mean, it's interesting because like I in the schools, there's a lot of talk about sex, right? So
yes.
Now in fifth grade, I think, everyone gets sort of educated about the birds and the bees, and the parents don't have to have the talk, mm-hmm. per se, because the kids hear it from school.
Well, this is an important role of school. It's to prevent having to have the difficult conversation.
At home? We'll take care of it for you.
Yeah.
We'll do the sex talk.
Yeah, pretty much. I remember when I was at school, they were following a particular theory. It was like fear theory or something like that. And they would show like horrifying pictures of the consequences, and to stop me from having unprotected sex.
Oh, yeah.
Or to have sex, period, because these were really horrifying pictures.
Yeah. Well, they do that with drunk driving. And drugs. It's the same thing. The schools do that when they're like, you know, Red Asphalt is that scary movie of what happens if you drive drunk. So I think the schools are having those lessons.
But anyway, it's kind of a different problem than we're talking about here. Their job is, how do I have a difficult conversation to prevent a really, really difficult conversation?
Yeah, interesting.
And they use techniques I would never use at home.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're talking with Dr. Sujata Patel about having hard conversations. And I think it's clear that we shouldn't use that fear-based approach.
Yes, because it teaches that sex is bad and scary, and that's not really a value we want to press onto our kids. I think it's for that topic, it's a lot of small conversations rather than one big conversation. So over the years, when things come up, you discuss it. You talk about things you see in the media. Teach your values to your kids. Set an example of what it's like to be comfortable talking about sex. Because if people can't talk about sex, they shouldn't really be having sex.
Oh my God, I have failed in so many ways.
Dan, you need to be celibate from now on. I think there's a lot of conversations that parents are really really are hard for them to have, particularly because, like you said, the kids sometimes know more than the parents. I mean, I'm thinking about phones and social media and, you know, when is the appropriate time to have a phone, or when do you have a talk about appropriate behavior on social media and bullying and that kind of stuff. And they know so much more. They're the digital natives, and I don't even know what I'm talking about when I start naming apps. Right. So what do you do in that case where the kids kind of know more than the parents?
I think they love being experts. So asking them a lot of questions about things you don't know much about, letting them explain it to you is helpful. I think just kind of watching what they're doing, also what we're doing. I think as parents, we model good phone behavior for our kids. So if we're on the phone at the dinner table, they're going to be on the phone at the dinner table.
Yeah.
If we take our phone, we get home and put it aside and don't check it constantly, they're not going to check it constantly either.
Right.
And if they do, you can ask them, oh, what's so interesting? What's going on right now? They don't want to share that with you. So they'll probably put the phone down and walk away.
That's a nice little technique. What's so interesting that you have to stop looking at me while I'm speaking with you and talk to your friends on the phone? And then they're going to stop.
Probably they'll put it away for now.
Nice. Sneaky.
So I had a... This is really tangential, but I had an undergraduate who wanted to work in my lab. And she asked me a question, and I'm starting to answer it. And as soon as she did it, she picked up her cell phone. And she's looking at it while I was answering.
Oh.
And I stopped talking for about 20 seconds. She finally noticed. I said, you realized that you asked me a question, I started to answer, and you didn't pay attention. You looked at your cell phone. She says, well, that's the way we all are now. You have to get used to it.
So she did not get that job.
It was not, it may have been a difficult conversation, but it didn't feel difficult because I said to her, someplace else, not here.
Wow. I mean, I know that I've talked with medical students and professors, and the professors are frustrated that the residents are just checking phones maybe during a shift or wearing inappropriate clothing or revealing too much. And I think my thought was their parents didn't have these conversations with them early enough, and now it's starting to eke into the workplace. Mm-hmm. So I think all the more reason why we have to be brave and do those hard and not just keep delaying those hard conversations. Do you see that in your work?
I do sometimes. I actually think what happens is parents worry about upsetting their children, and then what I see often are students who worry about upsetting their parents.
Mm.
They don't want to call their parents and tell them they're dealing with anxiety or depression because they think their parents won't be able to handle it.
Right.
Right.
And it's because the parents model this idea that difficult feelings shouldn't be handled.
So do you? Yes, that is correct.
No. Somebody sitting next to me is modeling that.
Do you give them tips for how to call their parents?
Yes, I do.
What's an example?
Well, I tell them that you can help your parents handle their feelings about you. You can reassure them. You can check in with them regularly. You can tell them, hey, Mom, I know it's hard for you to have me so far away. And model for them talking about the emotions that are coming up. Because often they may be ahead of their parents on some of these measures just by the fact of coming into therapy and talking about their feelings.
Dad, I've decided that I want to major in art history.
That should not be a hard conversation. And yet we know for many parents that is not what they want to hear. Well, thank you so much for the tips and the tools, and especially the concept that you don't want to delay these hard conversations, that you don't want to jump in and solve problems, that you really want to listen, and that if both parties feel heard, that's going to be a good way.
Yeah,
a good ending.
That was profound.
Yeah, so thank you so much for being here. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of the episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.